From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Ever wonder what some of the great writers of the English language sounded like?
It's true that at 40, when most people are getting worried about old age, I was just beginning to live. That happened because I met with Paris.
That's provocateur and novelist Henry Miller. Later this hour, we'll hear more writers in their own words. Today, saying the world. Why a radically simplified version of English is becoming the new common tongue. We'll introduce you to Globish. And new words in the blogosphere, from Oh My Lady Gaga to Yakka Wow. We'll explore what words say about the times we live in.
In the Times, they were quoting Baroness Greenfield, who's a neuroscientist, and they thought she said Yakka Wow, and she said yuck and wow. And it seemed to capture people's imagination, and the Yakka Wow meme went everywhere.
Also, saying it out loud with bumper stickers. Ben Schott writes the blog Schott's Vocab for the New York Times. It's his job to troll the internet for new and noteworthy words, whether they live a day or a year. Schott talked to Steve Paulson. He says words tell us volumes about the times we live in.
Ralph Waldo Emerson said language is the archive of history. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, I'm glad you asked me. I'm sure a lot of Emerson scholars would be thrilled that I'm going to answer on his behalf. I suspect he was communicating what I hope in a very small way I can carry on, this notion that the way we use language says a tremendous amount about the times in which we live. And of course, you know, language changes. It's this sort of endless... I mean, the people who would want language stuck in aspic and who get very, very agitated about new words or neologisms or about new usages of old words must realize that, of course, language is constantly changing. And even a word like nice, for example, horrendously overused by children and it's kind of lost all its meaning, it had a completely different meaning 150 years ago. You know, a nice distinction meant a very kind of mean-minded and finickety one, whereas nice nowadays just seems a sort of bland, you know, any word catch-all. So I think Emerson was saying that, you know, we have to look at language and we have to sort of capture it on the fly because it tells us about the times in which we live.
So is that what you are doing with your Schott's Vocab for the New York Times? You're looking to sort of catch this moment in history?
Well, I hope so. I mean, the Schott's Vocab blog was designed really to be a way of filtering news stories by looking at language. So either they are words that suddenly just appear because they just hit the news, or they are words from another culture, a different language, which tells us something odd about, you know, another aspect of the world.
Now, language is this incredibly liquid medium. I mean, constantly changing and new words pop up. Are you looking for the particular words and phrases that will stick?
I think so. Or words that tell us something about the time in which we live. I mean, sometimes the words that I select are clearly words that are just going to die and they just had a moment. And, you know, they're not particularly vital, but they do tell us something. I mean, you know, hope. The notion of hope and the notion of change around Obama's election. Now, these aren't particularly new words, quite the opposite. And then Sarah Palin comes and asks, how's that hopey-changey thing working out for you? Hopey-changey thing. I mean, just now, in 10 years, what I hope is you'll read this, you'll go back and you'll think, oh, I remember that. And often it's the footnotes that you really remember. And, you know, the idea of hopey-changey, it was a wonderfully cynical parody of Obama's lexicon. And it just absolutely nailed a moment when people thought, well, I don't know, maybe Obama isn't quite what we maybe hoped he might be.
And it seems like a lot of the new words have to do with technology. I mean, is this sort of an especially rich mine of words for you?
I think so. I mean, technology is interesting because, of course, we are forced to take on new words because they're in new concepts. I mean, the notion of, say, Wi-Fi, you know, it's astonishing how quickly this has just entered the world. And, you know, for anyone who travels for business or needs to be in touch, the first thing you ask a hotel is, have you got Wi-Fi? 10 years ago, they'd stared blankly at you. Many hotels in Britain still stare blankly at you. But technology is a huge driving force, partly because technology creates new thought processes. I mean, the notion of Bluetooth, and as I said, Wi-Fi, and texting, and SMSing, and tweeting, and poking, Facebook has an entire new vocabulary of words. In the same way, and I have to say personally, I object to this, in the same way that if you go into certain coffee chains, you're forced to use their language. And of course, let's not forget that all brainwashers, the first thing brainwashers do is make you use their terminology. And ordering a grande, I think, of any kind of coffee is probably akin to brainwashing as far as I'm concerned.
I agree with that. That always rubs me the wrong way when I go into Starbucks. And, you know, since when is the little one the grande? That is the little one, isn't it?
You know what? I don't know. I go in and say, I want a small black coffee, please. And I will just stare at them. I will stare them down. And they'll say a grande or whatever. And I'll say, no, I want a small black coffee. And, you know, I have the money in my hand, so I'm going to win. But it is true. Quite a lot of these new words I'm not particularly happy with. There's one that was quite pleasing, and this came from China, amongst China's young internet users, this Oh My Lady Gaga, which is apparently the modern replacement for OMG, Oh My God, as a way to express shock, hilarity, or to emphasise a point. So all around the internet in Japan, Chinese netizens, as they're called, citizens on the net, are typing Oh My Lady Gaga.
So it's sort of Oh My God, but with an ironic tone.
One would hope so. Oh my God, but with slightly fewer clothes on. It's hard to say.
Now, does a word ever actually change the way we think about something?
I mean, there are absolutely words. Something like boomer, for example, the greatest generation, it certainly sets a tone. And I think there are words that somehow, they hit a moment and they can communicate something and they do last. Often, I mean, what's difficult about writing a blog is finding them and spotting them when you hear them. I mean, quantitative easing, for example, a very kind of strange Rococo phrase that essentially means printing more money. It's one of those weird little phrases that came in and actually has a huge, massive symbolic impact as to what's happening in the economy. And QE is a sort of technical term that's been around and economists have used it for years. And it's often interesting when technical words, for whatever reason, either say the pandemic, I mean, H1N1, a technical term suddenly was everywhere. And so quite often they're technical terms that, for whatever reason, often ill, enter into the mainstream and change the way people think.
And then there are entirely non-technical terms like yakka wow.
Yeah, yakka wow, a great phrase that was actually a mishearing. It's a portmanteau of yuck and wow. And in the Times, they were quoting Baroness Greenfield, who's a neuroscientist, and they thought she said yakka wow, and she said yuck and wow. And it seemed to capture people's imagination, and the yakka wow meme went everywhere. And I don't know, I quite like mishearings and overhearings. There was a glorious moment when George Bush was at a big international state event with Tony Blair, and they both had their microphones on, and Bush walked up to Blair and said, "Yo, Blair." And for the British media, that was just, it summed up everything that they thought about Blair's sort of poodle-like relationship with George Bush.
Of course, I mean, the thing that's frustrating in a way is that, you know, you hear these stories about political gaffes and things that people shouldn't say, even if they really believe them. And, you know, the conclusion you have to come to is they should use the blandest language possible, because otherwise it'll get them in trouble.
Well, what you realize, and you only have to look at, say, the healthcare debate in America, what you realize is that the words politicians use are, I think quite sadly, focus grouped to death. And you only have to look at the notion of the phrase death panel, an astonishingly powerful phrase that really captured people's imagination. And there are highly paid, very talented consultants who literally spend their days putting phrases, talking points to focus groups to try and get the exact phrase. You know, if you call something a tax, that's one thing. If you call it a rebate, that's another. If you call it an allowance, I mean, you know, the notion of redefining, as they did in Britain, unemployed to job seeker. Well, it's a very, very interesting definition. And you only have to look at, you know, the work of George Orwell to realize that politics and language are hugely intertwined. And I don't think politicians are speaking in more banal terms. I think they're speaking in much more coded terms. In Australia, there's this phrase, dog whistle politics, which is a way of speaking about, say, race or religion or abortion in a coded way. So it sounds reasonable, but people who know what you're talking about know what the phrases you're using. And I think political language gets more and more complicated and more subtle, and it makes it harder for, you know, the average Joe voter to know exactly what's going on and to know the extent to which they're being manipulated.
So to go back to that example in England, trying to replace unemployment with job seeker, did that work? I mean, did job seeker catch on?
Well, it's interesting. You often get politicians talking about the unemployed and then stopping themselves and saying, I mean, job seekers. We had something called the community charge, which was a hugely unpopular tax that was called the poll tax, and there were poll tax riots. And the party that brought it in were under strict instructions never to refer to it as the poll tax. But every now and again, it slipped out because the good phrase will. I don't know. I think as voters, we need to be very, very careful about how language is co-opted and to the extent we're being manipulated. I think in some ways, the right is very good in America. You only have to look at Sarah Palin's language to realize how clever it is. And both Sarah Palin and George Bush had this this sort of myth of folksy language, plain spoken. It was all about, you know, down at home, this is the way we speak. And it's not plain spoken. It's incredibly subtle and very, very well articulated. And I think we ignore that at our peril. We ignore the fact that language is incredibly powerful at our peril.
Do you think language is becoming globalized, at least these words in English?
Oh, I mean, without any doubt. I mean, quite a lot of the words on the Schott's Vocab blog come from Japan, India, China. Often they're at countries where there's an intersection between English and Indians. There's Indian English and there's a fantastic amount of Chinglish, which is Chinese English. If I just look through some of the recent words on the blog that have come from China, you realize how many there are. And often they seem quaint and strange, but they really do tell us something about, you know, the notion of globalization. There's one actually from Haiti, one of my favorite terms that was on the blog, which is actually quite disturbing, but it sums up what I hope the Schott's Vocab blog does. It was acid battery, spelled A-S-I-D-B-A-T-R-Y. And it stood out because it was such a curious misspelling, and it's a kind of pidgin English spelling of acid battery. And it's used in Haiti to describe the pain of starvation, because starvation feels like acid battery in the stomach. And it was an astonishing phrase, because I thought, well, A, this is really interesting. B, it's very curious, the pidgin English, the way the English is sort of, you know, casualized. And C, sorry, there's a famine in Haiti. I just didn't know this. And so often words give you little insights into, you know, how other cultures and other countries are living. It's very strange.
Hmm. Now, going through your Schott Vocab, there are these, well, there are just so many great phrases that seem to capture the moment. Fat finger trades, for instance.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of dispute about this. I don't know if any of your listeners realize, but the stock markets around the world plummeted. Just astonishing, a free fall for a very short period of time before rebounding. And there was a lot of, there still is a lot of debate and dispute about why this happened. And there's all sorts of conspiracy theories, as you can imagine. But one of the theories was this so-called fat finger trade, which is a slang expression used amongst traders, which is essentially a mistyping. And there was a question of whether somebody mistyped millions for billions or vice versa, and this caused shares to plummet. Now, this has been denied. There's a Simpsons episode, I think, where Homer Simpson gets very obese and his fat fingers mean, I think there's a meltdown in the Springfield nuclear plant. maybe they knew exactly what they were writing about.
Well, and then there's another phrase, maybe related, suicide cuisine.
Suicide cuisine is wonderful, and quite a lot of my favorite words are food-related because it just seems an endless source. Suicide cuisine was a phrase, I think a Wired journalist created it, and it's glorious. It was used, I think, to sum up foods like, now KFC have a double-down burger. Now, I think I'm right in saying what they've done is they've taken the bold decision that burgers and sandwiches really aren't doing their job because of all of that bread. So what happens if you took the bread and you replace that with fried chicken? So you have a fried chicken, fried chicken sandwich, which is kind of genius now you think about it. It's amazing we survived as a civilization without dispensing with bread. So yeah, the suicide cuisine was just one of many horrific examples of food that we really shouldn't be eating.
One of my favorite words that I came across on your blog is, I don't know if I'm saying this right, the faux-amiens, the sort of the fake bohemians.
Oh, yes, the Fomians. As far as I remember, this was an attempt to redefine the word hipster. I think Gorka had decided that hipster was dead and we didn't need hipster anymore. So the Fohemians was an example. I think this is true. I think, well, it's interesting, the sort of hipster look that you certainly get around areas in New York, and I'm sure lots of other places, Seattle and Portland, just spring to mind. You know, these people who appear to have lots of high-end Apple Mac products and no real job.
Ben Schott writes the Schott's Vocab blog for the New York Times. He's also the author of the Schott's Almanac series. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Coming up, the great writers in their own words. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When words escape us, society turns to its writers to make sense of the world. Usually, writers let their books do the talking. But sometimes the authors step out from behind the book and speak for themselves. Their real-life voices are often surprising and strangely fascinating. Recently, the BBC Library released rare recordings of some of the most prominent writers in recent history. In the CD sets, The Spoken Word, British Writers and American Writers. Richard Fairman produced and compiled the collections. Here he is, talking with Steve Paulson.
Sometimes there's only one recording still existing from a particular writer. For instance, Virginia Woolf, right?
Yes, I mean, that, of course, is one of the most famous of all. Virginia Woolf made three broadcasts for the BBC in her lifetime. We have the texts of all three. She typed them out. She made her notations in the margins, and all of those have been saved. But only one recording survives, an eight-minute extract of one of the programmes, and we're very proud and pleased to be able to be publishing that on a CD for the first time in its complete form.
In the old days, of course, when English was a new language, writers could invent new words and use them. Nowadays, it's easy enough to invent new words. They spring to the lips whenever we see a new sight or feel a new sensation. But we cannot use them because the English language is old. You cannot use a brand new word in an old language because of the very obvious, yet always mysterious fact that a word is not a single and separate entity. It is part of other words. Indeed, it is not a word until it is part of a sentence. Words belong to each other. Although, of course, only a great poet knows that the word incarnadine belongs to multitudinous seas.
So what is it that strikes you when you listen to Virginia Woolf talking?
Of course, everybody says, my goodness, is that how she sounded? Some people expect she would have had a high voice, and in fact, she has quite a low voice. Other people think she would have wanted to talk about very high intellectual matters. And this is a slightly fusty, broadcast, prepared, written talk. And she's clearly reading off the page. So you do get a very particular feeling about her as a person that's perhaps surprising.
How far back do these recordings go?
Well, the earliest ones, of course, date from the early years of radio, which is to say around 1930. We have Rudyard Kipling from 1933, Baroness Orczy, if you remember her, author of The Scarlet Pimpernel from 1934, and a rather lovely little prepared sort of scene with other people playing characters, which is most amusing. Obviously the kind of thing they liked in that period on the radio. We have Gertrude Stein speaking on a BBC programme called American Points of View, a very rare extract of her just speaking spontaneously, not reading from one of her books.
So what was it that stood out to you when you first heard that recording of Gertrude Stein?
Oh, we were amazed when we heard that. I mean, people just don't speak like that.
Everybody has their own English, and it is only a matter of anybody getting used to an English, anybody's English, and then it's all right. After all, when you say they do not understand Four Saints, what do you mean? Of course they understand, or they would not listen to it. You mean by understanding that you can talk about it in the way that you have the habit of talking, putting it in other words. But I mean by understanding enjoyment. If you enjoy it, you understand it. And lots of people have enjoyed it, so lots of people have understood it.
She speaks as though she is an audio book. It's incredible. That's sort of true Gertrude Stein sentences that go on for lines and lines and lines with no punctuation. You think, my goodness, when did her brain stop to think?
No, it's so revelatory, I guess I want to say, when I listen to these recordings, I mean, because, of course, I have a sense of who these authors are when I read their books, but somehow hearing their voices adds an extra dimension. I'm not exactly sure what that says about the writers, but it certainly puts them in a new light.
It does. I mean, it always seems to me that we know these writers. We have writers of fiction here and playwrights as well on these sets. We know them through the characters that they put in their books and in their plays, but they're like masks, aren't they? And here, the masks are off, and we're hearing them speaking as ordinary people. That, I think, is what is so surprising. And with some of them, I feel I'm suddenly become their greatest friends. I mean, Henry Miller, I feel I could walk up to him in the street and I'd know exactly who he was and he'd know who I was because he's so open and friendly and buoyant. I mean, a recording like that, an interview so spontaneous, it is fantastic to hear.
I was in Paris when I wrote Tropic of Cancer. I had written three books before in America, but I didn't consider them any good. But it's true that at 40, when most people are getting worried about old age, I was just beginning to live. That happened because I met with Paris, yeah, because of the atmosphere around me and the particular friends that I met. But mostly the atmosphere, the general atmosphere. I don't mean just one thing, bars or dining rooms and meals and so on, but everything about Paris, the circulation in the streets, the language itself, the slang, every aspect of the city was something of great vital importance to me, and like a lesson to learn, you know.
You have a conversation between Ian Fleming and Raymond Chandler. It's an interesting combination.
It is. They were good friends, apparently, and this was the last time that they met, because Chandler died very shortly afterwards. It is, incidentally, believed to be the only recording surviving of Chandler's voice. So there are a number of reasons why this is rather interesting. And the two of them settle down like two masters of the thriller in front of the fireside and have a very chummy chat. Fleming rarely asks Chandler the questions that I would like to ask him, which is rather frustrating. Not only that, Chandler had a very bad cold, for one thing, and had also been at the whiskey before he arrived at the studio. So the interview is a real one-off. But just to have these two great names sitting together, of course, that's something everybody wants to hear.
Well, the first thing, I suppose, Ray, really, is to define what we're supposed to be talking about. And I think the title of what we're supposed to be talking about is English and American thrillers. The first thing is, what is a thriller? And in my mind, of course, you don't write thrillers, and I do.
I do, too.
I don't call yours a novel.
Well, other people call them thrillers.
I know, I think it's wrong.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you write novels of suspense, like Simenon does and Eric Ambler does, perhaps, but in which violence is the background, just as love might be in the ordinary kind of straight novel.
Well, in America, a thriller or mystery story writer, as we call them, is slightly below the salt.
Well, a thriller writer, yes, very below the salt, really.
You can write a very lousy, long, historical novel full of sex and can be a bestseller and can be treated respectfully.
Yes.
But a very good thriller writer who writes far, far better is just get the little paragraph, that's
yes,
all.
Yes, I know, it's probably true.
Mostly.
Yeah.
There's no attempt to judge him as a writer.
Well, I don't know, I suppose, but you yourself are judged as a writer, and Dashiell Hammett was,
yeah,
I think.
Yes, but how long did it take me? You starved to death for 10 years before your publisher knows you're any good.
I guess it kind of fits Raymond Chandler, doesn't it, to hear that he's been drinking before he comes in for the interview.
Oh, they all live up to their reputations.
And then you have Graham Greene, who tells a remarkable story about how apparently he played Russian roulette when he was younger.
That's right. He tells the story of how he used to go up on a hill outside Berkhamsted, where he lived here in England. I think he says he was around 16 at the time, or 17, with a revolver with one bullet, and he would have five shots of the bullet and see what happened. I mean, just chilling, and suddenly you realise where some of those exciting stories that have made such vivid films, all of them, over the years, you realise where all of that has come from.
You did, as a boy, play Russian roulette.
Yes.
With a loaded revolver. What on earth led you to spin a bullet in a revolver, taking one chance in six that you might kill yourself?
For excitement, to get away from the boredom. And it was very exciting the first time. It remained exciting for quite a while. I did it at long intervals. Perhaps a month would go by before I'd do it again. I became convinced that unconsciously I could tell from the weight where the charge was.
You also have a sense that there is a kind of existential angst that goes deep into Graham Greene.
Yes, I mean, he calls himself a hunted man at one point in the interview, and this sense of living on the edge of things and wanting to go out to far-flung places, all of which is in the books, it's all here in The Man as well. And this is one of the cases where the literature and the man come so closely together, you can almost see the sparks coming off them.
And then, in terms of some of your American writers, you have a recording of John Steinbeck talking about the origins of The Grapes of Wrath.
We do. That is one of the recordings that is not derived from the BBC, though as far as we know, it hasn't been published. Some slightly odd extracts have appeared on the internet in which various sentences seem to be run together. This has gone back to the original version of the interview.
When I wrote The Grapes of Wrath, I was filled naturally with certain angers, and certain angers at people who were doing injustices to other people, or so I thought. I realize now that everyone was caught in the same trap. If you remember, we had a depression at that time. The depression caught us without the ability to take care of it. It took a long time for us to develop the agencies to take care of such economic difficulties. When the dust came up, people were starving and they had no place to go. Naturally, they went to in a direction where they would not suffer from cold. They went toward California. They came in their thousands to California. And what did they meet? They met a people who were terrified, well, number one, of depression, and were horrified at the idea that great numbers of indigent people were being poured on them to be taken care of.
Stunning content again, to hear Steinbeck himself describe events in the Depression era, how he went out as a journalist, met these families who were so stricken with poverty that it sent him back to write this great book. And very vivid now, of course, a true Critic Crunch novel, and the interview seeming as if it could have been on the radio yesterday.
And you have a wonderful excerpt from Lillian Hellman talking about her experience before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1952.
Well, I'm glad you like that one. Nobody else has ever mentioned it, because that is my favorite of the whole lot of all the 57 interviews here. That, unusually, is the soundtrack to a television interview. And I presume that the interview took place over a very long period, because she sounds extremely relaxed. She really gives very measured answers to these penetrating questions about why she is a writer, what politics meant to her, and so on. And almost more than with any of the others, I feel that a writer who was then at the end of her career, near the end of her life, is looking back deep into her soul and saying what it was that made her Lillian Hellman. And I feel it comes across in that interview in an extremely moving way.
Dear Mr. Wood, as you know, I am under subpoena to appear before your committee on May the 21st, 1952. I am most willing to answer all questions about myself. I have nothing to hide from your committee, and there is nothing in my life of which I am ashamed. But I am advised by my counsel that if I answer the committee's questions about myself, I must also answer questions about other people, and that if I refuse to do so, I can be cited for contempt. To hurt innocent people whom I knew many years ago in order to save myself is to me inhuman and indecent and dishonorable. I would therefore like to come before your committee and speak only of myself. Sincerely yours, Lillian Hellman.
Richard Fairman produced and compiled the CD collections The Spoken Word British Writers and The Spoken Word American Writers for the BBC British Library. He talked with Steve Paulson. In 2004, an IBM executive named Jean-Paul Nerriere announced the emergence of a new lingua franca. He called the language Globish. According to Nerriere, this radically simplified version of English has become the world's common tongue. Robert McCrum takes up the case in his new book, Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. McCrum told me that the more you look, Globish is everywhere.
And I became increasingly aware, as time went on, of this global reach that it had and the way in which the ideas that it was expressing were being picked up all over the world by non-native speakers of English and my eureka moment, if you want, came in about 2005 in September. I don't know whether you can recall those protests against the cartoons that appeared in the Danish magazine of the Prophet Muhammad.
Oh, well, of course.
There was a tremendous outcry all across the Muslim world, and a lot of people got killed. There were riots in Afghanistan, Nigeria, all over the place. And there was one particular demonstration which really caught my eye and caught my imagination. There was a demonstration of fundamentalists in London, outside the Danish embassy in Park Lane. And these guys, who were all from Saudi Arabia and the Far East and all over the place, marched down Park Lane, and they marched outside the embassy, and they carried slogans like, "Behead the infidel." And the one that caught my attention was, "Down with free speech."
Down with free speech.
Down with free speech, which seemed to me a sort of surreal collision of Alice in Wonderland with the jihad. So here they are. Here are these Muslim fundamentalists in London using English to denounce the freedom which had allowed them to make the protest.
There have been arguments for years that English is the language people use to talk business around the world. Mm. But this is something more than that.
What I'm saying is it's as though the language is kind of encoded with ideas of freedom, ideas of liberty, the ideas of self-expression, the ideas of asserting oneself, of explaining things in a simple form against an oppressive dominant force. And this goes back, I say, to the Norman Conquest and before that. So I'm saying that the language is somehow, as I say, encoded with these ideas, so that the language carries with it, as it were, a way of life or a way of looking at the world. Now, that could be said to be sort of faintly imperialistic. I'm saying that it's now being adopted by people all over the world with no sense of its British or its American history.
Let's talk a little bit about the language now to start this conversation, though, because I think you have to start with the way in which English has spread over the entire world.
One definition of globish is it's the use of English by non-native English speakers. And it was Monsieur Jean-Paul Nerrier who it was his discovery. He was a Frenchman. He was an IBM executive, and he was posted to Japan in 1995. And he made this observation. He observed that in meetings between Japanese and Koreans, or Japanese and Filipino, or whoever it was, the non-native speakers did much better in conversation in English with other non-native speakers than with English or American speakers, who are using nuance, allusion, idiom. And so he said that what he called a decaffeinated version of English, a simplified, stripped-down version, is much more useful internationally than the language that you and I are using, which is, you know, laden with all kinds of associations and idioms and styles, which would not mean much in somewhere like Japan.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that he went on to say, at least I believe that he went on to say, that in some ways the spread of English has preserved other languages.
I think what it is now, it is the default position. If you're a German or a Pole or a Ukrainian or a Georgian or an Iranian, you know, whatever you are, and you need to communicate with somebody else, a Punjabi or a Japanese, the language that you will turn to, if neither of you can communicate in some other language, will be English. So in that sense, the mother tongues are not being threatened. It's like an alternative. It's like a parallel universe to which people can turn when they need to make a communication internationally. And so globish is this parallel universe, which is a kind of English.
Which raises the question, of course, how is this happening? How are people learning English, or globish, if you will, in places where it isn't the first language?
Well, in somewhere like China, it's being taught by rote in these extraordinary open-air, these sort of mass language schools where 10,000 people repeat English. It's an extraordinary scene. It's called Crazy English. And they learn English by rote, by repeating after the teacher. I mean, that's one extreme example. Then, obviously, in other places like Mexico or something, it will be taught in primary schools. So it's being picked up in all kinds of different ways. And, of course, in somewhere like India, it's being taught by language schools, language classes. People are learning it, turning to it as this way out of non-communication.
Why do you think it is that English was so ripe to be developed into globish?
Well, mainly for one extraordinary historical reason, which was that one empire, let's say the British Empire, which was, as you know, covered a quarter of the globe in the 19th century, was followed by another empire, that's to say the Pax Americana, the American Empire, which used essentially the same language and the same set of cultural references. I mean, this has never happened before. When Greece gave way to Rome, you moved from Greek to Latin, which was, I mean, similar but not just very different. In this case, the decline of Britain was followed by the rise of the US, during the First and Second World Wars, and that is the essential reason why the globe is anglicised.
Mm. And saying anglicised is interesting too. You start the history of English and its journey to globish with the Anglo-Saxon invasion of Britain. Their footprints are all over it, aren't they?
Yeah, in any sentence that we're using, you cannot get away from what I call the building blocks. You know, the words like is, the, man, house, all these simple words, simple monosyllabic words, are almost all Anglo-Saxon. They are at the core of the way we speak.
And you begin to build the core of the language that we use, too, and the ideas behind it with all of the great English writers, Shakespeare and Samuel Johnson. And the things that they thought and believed, I guess, traveled with the language as it moved.
Yeah, so the language is like a kind of virus. It's a kind of benign virus which carries, first of all, meaning, but also association. And the associations are the associations to Lincoln, Mark Twain, Shakespeare, you've mentioned, Johnson, yes. All these writers who've gone around the world are associated with this little linguistic virus.
You would think that the objection to the empire and the objection to American military might would have pushed people away from English.
Well, that is the extraordinary thing, and that is why I say, how is it that it was not only survived, but was also adopted? So, that for example, in India, during the protests against the British Raj, the opposition, Indian nationalist opposition, chose to use English as a way of expressing their opposition to the imperial. Now, why is that? It's completely counterintuitive. And I'm saying it's to do with the, as I say, the association of libertarian ideas which the language carries.
How was the language itself then shaped by the imperialism that carried it abroad?
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting question. It was shaped by warfare, shaped by advertising and trade. Somebody once said that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. And in some senses, English arrived abroad at the point of a musket or a cannon or a bayonet. We cannot overlook the fact that the benefit that we derive today begins with bloodshed and mayhem and all kinds of oppression. There's no question of denying that. That's the fact of it.
And so you have the language carrying ideas both ways. You talked about the force of popular culture. Certainly, things like Coca-Cola and jeans have traveled around the world, and I suppose in that sense the language came with them. How much weight do you think the language of Western popular culture carries?
I think you have to look quite closely at individual examples. I mean, a film like Precious is a good example. A film like Slumdog Millionaire is a very good example. And that's a real case study, because that was a novel written by an Indian diplomat, Vikram Swarup, in Indian English, which was then turned into a script by a British scriptwriter and then filmed by a Scot in Mumbai with a Bollywood cast. So God knows what the English is, but anyway, it's certainly not the English that you are using. But there's an example of the process I'm describing, this kind of tremendous mishmash of styles, ideas, vocabulary, grammar, all mashed together into this glorious mixture.
You know, we're talking about the glories of English, and certainly it is a rich and varied language. Are there losses to English that come from the development of globish?
That's a very interesting question. I think probably not, because I think at the level at which you and I are communicating now in international radio communication, nothing has been lost by, we aren't simplifying this discussion for any globish purposes. On the whole, the benefit to the language comes from, I mean, Walt Whitman talked about change bubbling up from below, and I think the thing about English that's characteristic of it, it tends to borrow from the mass culture and tends not to be affected. I'm sure there are purists who will say that the English is being corrupted, and the people have always said this. People have always said it's been corrupted by change. But personally, I don't see that. People have worried about those corruptions. Shakespeare worried about them. Shakespeare's contemporaries worried about them. Jonathan Swift worried about them. Johnson worried about them. There were Americans like John Adams who was concerned about these things. But on the whole, it's like a compost. It goes on getting richer and richer and stranger. And more nutritious, too.
Robert McCrum is associate editor at The Observer and the author of Globish, How the English Language Became the World's Language. Coming up, making sense of the world in 10 words or less. You can become a Facebook fan of To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website. You'll find a link at ttbook.org. And drop us a message while you're there. We always love to hear from you. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. The world is a complex place. Maybe that's why bumper stickers are so comforting. Slap one on your car and you get to advertise your chosen philosophy to hordes of people. The catch, you only get 8 or 9 words in which to do it. So they better count. Menlo School philosophy teacher Jack Bowen has made a study of bumper stickers. He writes about them in the book, If You Can Read This, The Philosophy of Bumper Stickers. Bowen told Ann Strainchamps about how he got interested in bumper stickers.
It was actually a specific bumper sticker that I saw while I was teaching a segment on the death penalty in a class. And I saw it that morning when I was driving around, actually getting my morning coffee. And it said, why do we kill people? To show people that killing people is wrong. And I actually started class by just writing that on the board and, of course, citing my source. And the kids just dove in and were like having these great discussions based on this sort of terse summary of a much deeper philosophical issue. And I realized, wow, there's really something to this. Like, they're not intimidated in any way. They feel welcomed. They can connect. And so that was sort of the springboard.
Yeah, it's interesting because we tend to think that bumper stickers, or I tend to think that bumper stickers are just these little kind of throwaway, slightly funny taglines people stick on their cars, but you're suggesting they can be like little cones or they can have some deep philosophy embedded in them.
Well, yeah, I tend to agree with you on maybe on the face value of it. The other bumper sticker that I, you know, in tandem with the death penalty bumper sticker that sort of got things going was one that I threw out at a dinner party. And the bumper sticker is, what if the hokey pokey is what it's all about? And I actually, I do use this in my book because what happened when I threw that out at the dinner party is all of a sudden everyone's doing, you know, what Emily Post tells us not to do is talking about big ideas and the meaning and purpose of life at the dinner table. And I don't think that the person who put that sticker on their car was really making this value judgment about the hokey pokey being the meaning of life. Like, my guess is they're making a joke, or maybe they're poking fun at the whole meaning of life question. But in that sense, it gives us a real door to open and say, but what could the meaning of life be now that we've sort of got it on the table?
Well, so where did this conversation at the dinner party go about
exactly. The way that I would hope that it would have gone is that someone did respond and they said, you know, yeah, it's funny, but isn't that kind of what life's all about to begin with? I mean, whatever your version of sort of, you know, shaking it all about. And, you know, someone else said, yeah, I mean, if we're not happy, if we're not pursuing happiness, then what is the meaning of it? And then someone responded, but wait a minute, there's got to be something more sort of intrinsically meaningful to life than just, you know, this shaking it all about. It really did generate a conversation that I don't think I could have done otherwise.
What's the best conversation you've ever had based on a bumper sticker?
I was at a book club two or three weeks ago. It was a group of women who had read the book and they were local and we had a really fun time talking. And one of the women said, you know, there was a bumper sticker that wasn't even in my book, but she and her son had read some of this book together and they were out driving and they saw a bumper sticker that said, look busy, Jesus is coming. And she said, we had one of the best conversations we've ever had sort of about religion and about the way that the woman was saying the way that I was raised. And he asked a question about, are they kind of making fun of religion or are they saying we really should look like, but her point was that once you realize the potential that's sort of couched in these terse statements, it really does lead to the potential for a lot of great conversation.
You've boiled some bumper stickers down into some basic types, one of which is the if-then bumper sticker, you know, as in the famous, if you can read this, then you're too close. What do you think about that whole type of bumper sticker?
Well, I think most of the if-then bumper stickers are playful. You know, if you can read this, then you're within range and there's a bullseye, or, you know, it's written in Braille and says if you can read this, then you're too close. And they typically are playful, but I sort of use that a little bit as a metaphor, as sort of an invitation. I mean, the if-then clause is very important in logic, which is a lot of what drives, you know, critical thinking. But it's sort of a playful invitation that, you know, if you can read this, then, and it's sort of like that's what this book is, or maybe the bumper sticker culture in general and philosophy in general is, then you can come participate in this really big, exciting discussion. So I sort of use it as a metaphor for the invitation that bumper stickers are to doing philosophy.
You said the if-then clause is an important one in logic. Is there an actual philosophy to the if-then clause?
I don't know if I would call it like a philosophy per se. You know, logicians have these sort of, I call them annoying names. I actually kind of like them in sort of a Monty Python way. Modus ponens and modus tollens. And there are these logical laws that if the statements are true, then the conclusion must be true. So sort of if A happens, then B happens. A happens, therefore B happens. That's the logical law of modus ponens. But what's exciting about it is it's not only an invitation, but it's a way of discerning sort of deeper truths through this logical method. So I don't know if I'd say it's a philosophy in and of itself, but it certainly drives a lot of our thinking, whether or not we're cognizant of it.
Hmm. There's one type of bumper sticker that's almost universally ridiculed, and that's the I Heart. You know, I heart New York, I heart Akron, Ohio, I heart Welsh corgis. Does philosophy explain at all what it is that's so irritating about those I heart bumper stickers?
The tact I took with that sticker was to actually look at sort of the philosophical foundations of love. And we can kind of go all the way back to Plato, who I think is nicely summarized by Owen Wilson in the movie Wedding Crashers, when he's flirting with the bridesmaid who's about to give a toast for her sister. And he quotes Plato, he paraphrases Plato, saying love is one soul's counterpart in another. And so we can look at love from that level, but also look at it from a really, like from an evolutionary standpoint, and look at the pheromones that are involved and the notions of symmetry. I mean, Cate Blanchett has earned the moniker of our species' most symmetrical face, right? Mm-hmm. And this symmetry is really important to us. And all of the chemicals that go into creating the butterflies in the stomach and the, you know, endless thoughts of the beloved through epinephrine and norepinephrine and all these things. So I avoided the potential annoyance of the I Heart collection and looked more at these sort of deeper notions of love.
You have to admire the brevity of bumper stickers. There's a whole class of them in which people have boiled down, you know, large statements about belief into not even words, but just a little symbol. I'm thinking of the famous Christian fish. And then you've got a whole list of the variations on that. I had no idea there were so many.
Yeah, I finally had to just stop short because, well, clearly there are as many as there are, you know, supernatural beings. I think we're up to 1,023 religions as of a month ago. But it was really interesting not only to look at the history of the Christian fish, which is actually quite fascinating, sort of looking at, you know, the secret symbol used as an arrow and to avoid persecution early on. But then, as you mentioned, there have been a lot of parodies everywhere from, you know, like I said, putting your respective God's name in the middle to evolutionists sort of putting, you know, legs on the fish or writing the word Darwin in the middle. And then we've got like the science fish eating the Christian fish, and we've got dinosaurs eating the fish. And then there are a couple that I think, again, are either just a way of being funny or maybe to parody this whole issue, where they put the word gefilte in the middle or end chips in the middle. It's interesting. And that's the one I'm always asked if I have a bumper sticker in my car, and I always say no, and I never have. And Uncle Dave, when I was on tour in Chicago, reminded me of his sister, my mother, who, when they gave me the old 1980 Volvo to drive back up to Stanford my junior year, my mom slapped a Christian fish on the back to help me meet a nice young woman.
How far back does that Christian fish symbol go?
Well, it goes all the way back. I mean, the first century is really, it was sort of an identifier to distinguish sort of Christians from others without being terribly outlandish so they could avoid persecution. So it relates to the son of the sea goddess Aphrodite, Ichthys. That's the sort of the name of the fish. And so that's where it gets its, pardon the term, its fishiness.
Do you have particular favorite bumper stickers?
Yeah, I've been forced to narrow this down because I started with this list of 2,200 and pared it down to about 160, which ended up in the book. So picking my favorite is a little bit like picking my favorite child. But if forced to pick, there are two that I like. One, I think, does serve a little bit as a foundation for what I think the virtue of philosophy. And it's, if ignorance is bliss, then why aren't more people happy?
Another if-then statement.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a deeper way of saying, well, you know, ignorance really isn't bliss. It might be bliss in the eating an ice cream cone sense of the term, but not in the deeper. The term that that I really like that Aristotle uses is flourishing. Like, it's ignorance is not bliss in the deeper sort of sense of flourishing. And I think that's one of the things that philosophy does. It's a sort of an antidote to ignorance.
So really, this bumper sticker poses a much deeper philosophical question.
I think it does. I think it poses a little bit of a way of life. It's sort of that, if you can use the movie The Matrix or The Truman Show, you know, kind of saying, do you want to be, you know, superficially blissful and ignorant, or do you want to sort of delve deeper and realize that there may be things that you wish weren't so and may not be as superficially blissful, but you'll have that sort of that deeper sense of knowledge, which will allow for flourishing. So it is, it's a little bit of a sort of an epistemological commitment, I guess.
So I want to ask you about my current favorite bumper sticker, because I can't quite figure out why it delights me so much, but it's, where are we going and why am I in this handbasket?
Ah, yes, I do enjoy that one myself, the, you know, hell in a handbasket. I mean, I certainly think there's just the pure rhetorical comedy of it. Anything where you're making the reader discover what's being said. If I mean, imagine a bumper sticker that says, we're going to hell in a handbasket. And you think, oh, that poor person. And no, we're not. But instead, if they frame it in that way that forces you to become engaged, just like a good advertisement. I mean, like, you know, an advertisement doesn't say this hamburger is better. They let you know that bigger is better. And they say ours is 22% bigger than our competitors. And then you, the listener, have to say, oh, wait a minute, that means that their burger's better. So here it's, I appreciate the rhetoric sort of forcing the listener or the reader in this case to say, wait a minute.
Jack Bowen teaches philosophy at the Menlo School in California. He's the author of If You Can Read This, The Philosophy of Bumper Stickers. Anne Strainchance spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 530A, Saying the World. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.